Well, we're moving into chapter 8 eventually tonight, but we're still finishing up 7. And what I'd like to do is maybe just give a quick background on, chapter 7 has to do with kind of with the social order in which we live. And because of that, we look at the big picture, just living kind of in society. And we looked at such topics last week as avoiding sin, acquiring not through injustice, looking out before you want to grab hold of authority and have authority, be careful because it has a lot of headaches with it and likewise a lot of temptations, and we will be judged if we have authority. Who to admire, we're told not to presume, we're told about alms and prayers, that we should keep our gaze fixed on God, always remembering that God is watching. And being careful about who we admire. And verses 15 to 17, and again, it went through there, if you might remember, where we tend to look down on certain occupations and we look up at others, and the scripture basically says, you don't know what you're talking about, every aspect of the economy, just like our bodies, is essential and necessary, and we shouldn't sort people out in terms of their dignity simply by the type of work they do. Finally, it ends with assigning proper value to things and so on. And we ended with a good place to end, which was dismiss not a sensible wife. A gracious wife is more precious than corals. And we talked a little bit again about, speaking about being a little edgy, we talked about men need that kind of advice. Remember, this is old men talking to younger men, same kind of thing as Proverbs. And a lot of young men, admire a woman's physical beauty, but the authors are reminding that what you really want to find is a good, sensible woman, a good, sensible wife, and she's more. That's the real precious. That's what really, obviously physical beauty is a nice thing, but it comes and goes, and also on. But in the end, men very often can be easily misled simply by physical beauty. And there's a caution. That's how we ended last week. Okay? So, with that in mind, we now go into, we kind of close the circle a little bit from the world out there. We now begin to look a little bit more at the question of the family and the extended family that we call the church, or, for their case, the synagogue. Now, I want to just ask you, though, to ponder with me before we get into material, because, again, we're being told here that we should reverence and revere our parents and our elders and so on. And I'd like to... I may have done this with you before, so if that's the case, again, remember repetition is the mother of studies, but let me ask you to give me some feedback about what you think is the reason that God is so adamant about respecting our elders. Remember, let me remind you how adamant it is. First of all, he put it in the Ten Commandments. Remember to honor your father and your mother. But beyond that, it was very severe in the Old Testament, the punishments that could be meted out for a child not honoring a parent. Literally, the death penalty. A child who upbraided their parent could be put to death. Now, I'm not saying they always enforced this law, but I'm just going to say that even today in the Middle East, in many parts of the Middle East, a father can kill a child with impunity. Nobody approves of it socially. It's an unacceptable practice. But the law generally doesn't go after fathers who kill their children. Basically, so that's a father's right. Now, that sounds barbaric to us. But remember, we're kind of at the other extreme, where we just kind of let kids talk back to old folks and parents and others with almost impunity. I mean, so let me just ask you again, without trying to sanction that extreme stuff, I'm just trying to give you some kind of a context, that the scriptures are very adamant about this concept of respecting our elders and honoring our parents and so on. So, ideas? I mean, God's just old-fashioned, right? Is that really all it's about? God didn't grow up in the 20th century, apparently. So, any ideas? The reason I ask is we kind of talked about this before. See, sometimes what happens to us as Christians and just people who try to follow God, is that sometimes, for those of us who have faith, it's kind of enough to know God says it, I'm going to do it. That's enough for a lot of us. But we're in a world today, increasingly, where that is not. In fact, I kind of grew up like that. You got to tell me why. It's not enough for you to just tell me the church says so. Well, what do a bunch of old white-haired men in the Vatican know? That was kind of my attitude when I was a teenager, anyway. And he starts just quoting the scriptures. I'm like, man, that thing was written by some human beings. Man, they're just trying to keep us down. See, I mean, so in other words, the argument from authority. I grew up in an era, and people my age and younger, it's just not enough to argue from authority. Now, maybe some of you who are a little older remember a time when, you know, just because the church said so, or because Father said so, or something was enough. But I don't know if it ever was, but. Certainly is not the case with young people today. They need to know why. Why does God command this? Not just that God commands it. So part of our task as people who want to share wisdom is to be able to give a rationale or reason. So any other, with that, you know, prodding, any ideas about why God is so adamant about listening to our elders?
Because of their wisdom.
Okay. So in other words, they have something to offer. Okay, so can you give me another sentence after that? Okay, she said because of their wisdom.
And experience.
Yeah, well, big whoop, man. I know a few things. I'm a young person, and I know a few things, and you're just old-fashioned, Miss Connie. I mean, what do you have to tell me, right? Okay, but I mean, again, you're on the right track. I just want to say that maybe we can begin to kind of fill in some of the details. Go ahead. Come in. All right. Well, let me try to get you started, because Connie kind of opened the door for us, and now it's my chance to kind of walk through it a little bit. Let me ask you a question: are you going to listen to somebody that you don't really respect?
No.
So, in other words, part of listening and learning involves trust, and it involves respect. Right? Now, therefore, if I don't trust you and don't listen to you, then what happens with the wisdom that you have? Does it get communicated to me?
No.
None. And not just like etiquette at parties or how to comb your hair, whatever, you know, whatever we may have learned in life. But even more importantly, religious truth. Who is God? Why was I made? What is the meaning of life, my existence? You know, what is right and what is wrong? So these are some pretty important things that need to be handed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, without respect, there can be no learning. Without respect and honor, there can be no handing on, not only of human traditions, but of God's teachings. Now do you begin to see why God is so adamant? If we do not command respect from our children and train them up this way when they're young, it is almost impossible for us ever to be able to teach them about God and about the things that are necessary for them to be saved. Okay? We've got to, it's not just about, I want you to respect me because I earned it or something. It's not about ego stuff only. It's about being able to say, you, when I speak to you, you will pay attention because you've learned to respect me. Okay. Now, this virtue, like any virtue, is taught. I understand that everyone has their own personality. I think some kids are just more naturally compliant and some are more naturally rebellious. I mean, there are personality issues at stake here. I understand that. But fundamentally, respect can be taught. Respect and honor are things that can be learned by being, first of all, exemplified, insisted upon, and properly punished when they are not, especially when the child is very young, properly punished when they're not heeded. Okay? So I think that, and God insists on it because in the end, we cannot hand on our faith or our culture and noble traditions if there isn't respect. And therefore, what begins to happen is civilization breaks down. Now, we don't have to conduct an experiment to figure this out. It's happening all around us, isn't it? See? You'll notice a number of things. We begin to see that social order has largely, not largely completely, but I mean it's largely in trouble right now. There's a lot of disorder. Basic things are kind of beginning to break down. For example, the graduation rate. Over at Blue High School, it was 40%. 40% of the kids who went into ninth grade made it, only 40% made it out through 12th grade. And again, of them, 60% of the 40% were functionally illiterate, according to the Washington Post. Now again, we talked about that last week. There's a lot of reasons for that, but part of it is what we call a breakdown of the handing on of wisdom. That, and we also see, concomitant with it, a breakdown of respect for elders, of obedience, of a sense. Now, by the way, the word obedience comes from the Latin ab audire, meaning to give a hearing, to be able to listen. That's the heart of obeying, to be able to hear, to listen, and to heed. But it comes from the Latin ab audire, to give a listening to. Now, so again, you see that we begin to see that discipline and SAT scores begin to break down. But getting a little closer to home, we also see that what has happened to church attendance as respect for elders and things like that has generally gone down. Respect for tradition, respect for elders, respect for the... Well, again, walk into church on Sunday morning. Now, most of you remember a time, I say most of you, many of you remember a time when we might have had 150 to 200 kids to be confirmed every year. And now there's, what do we have, about 10 right now? About 10 right now to be confirmed. Same with First Communion. There might have been 250, 300 kids in some of our First Communion classes going back in the 40s and the 50s. And now we're down to, we're going to be bringing 12 kids are going to receive their sacraments in May. So, you see, our numbers are way down, not just among young, but in general, and we're not able to hand on the faith and the traditions, but part of this is a breakdown of respect for elders, for respect for tradition, a respect for the wisdom that has gone before us. And this is something that we have not trained and handed on as a discipline to young people. Now, I would say we're probably into the second or third generation, maybe even some might argue the fourth generation of this type of dissing of what's gone before. Okay, there's always been a little bit of a generation gap, I'm sure. I mean, always young people kind of push the envelope a little bit and try to step out and sort of be them, be something different. But in the end, we've certainly gone through, I would say, since the late 60s, a real period of a real radical overthrow of what has come before and a complete skepticism of anything that was old, traditional, or in some way demarking an era that has gone before. Now, was everything great in the old days? Of course not. I'm in a room of largely African Americans, and you're the first, you'd be the first to tell me, hey, things weren't great in the 50s, Father. I mean, I'm not here to celebrate everything from the past. But in the end, we have to say that much has been lost that was good as well. So I would simply say to you that as a background to some of the things we're going to read, that there's a criticality that we recover a healthy sense of respect for elders, a healthy sense of respect for tradition, a healthy sense of commanding obedience from children. Not in a fearsome, beat them down, kind of rob them of any sense of independence or whatever, but a good, healthy, vigorous commanding of respect. Okay? So, I just wanted to do that with you because sometimes we jump into these things and it's possible for us to kind of get into the details and lose the big picture. But God is trying to teach us how important this is. Okay? Now, with that in mind, just a brief section, so why don't I just go ahead and read the verses one little by little. So the first thing is that those of us who have some authority are cautioned here. Mistreat not a servant who faithfully serves, nor a laborer who devotes himself to his task. Like, let a wise servant be dear to you as to your own self. Refuse him not his freedom. If you have livestock, look after them. If they are dependable, keep them. Okay, it's funny how they include livestock there at the end. But again, we all know that I think this is just good practical advice. You know, many of you have been supervisors or are now supervisors at work. You have certainly children and grandchildren and others. The idea here is that we don't just lord it over people under us. We don't. We treat them with respect, with a loving concern. We're as solicitous as we could be. Now, again, sometimes as leaders, we have to set the pace, and we have to say this is the way we need to walk in it. But we're always respectful. We try to be as collaborative. We hear the complaints. complaints and the grievances, and where possible we should make adjustments. And generally, the idea here is to, again, not to mistreat people who take care of us and serve us and care for us. All right? And I don't know if we need to spend a long period of time on this, but I think that most of us have had to work under people who didn't treat us that way. And, of course, we know that we weren't very motivated to really do well. We did what we had to, but really very little more. We met the minimum. We might have occasionally, you know, gone past the minimum out of some fear, but in the end we resented them, and we really weren't going to keep our... And I'm just talking about human nature now. We just weren't all that intrigued or interested in really looking out for them. If we began to see that some things were going in their direction that might cause them some difficulty, we said, good, fine, let it happen. And so, in other words, we lose a kind of a camaraderie and a team spirit if we mistreat people who we need to help us. So respect, reverence. Remember now, the concept of authority among Christians is that there is authority among Christians. We have to be clear on this. There is authority, but it's always exercised among equals. Okay. So that is to say that, well, let's just take the church for an example. Now, the Pope has authority in the church. Now, you know, we recognize that authority. But on the other hand, he's no more baptized than you or I. He's no more or less a child of God than you and I. See? He does have authority, though. Now, I mean, if I can talk about my own authority in this parish, oh, I have such... But I mean, you know, but I do have, as pastor, you know, some authority. And again, but remember, I'm no more baptized than any of you. You're my brothers and sisters. We're all equals before God. Okay? If anything... I'll have to answer even more than the rest of you. But the point is that, in the end, we always remember the first principle of Christian authority is that authority is always exercised among equals. Okay? Now, in the world, there's a different way of viewing authority and power. It's about power, isn't it? So I'm either richer than you are, I'm smarter than you are, I'm older than you are. I have something up over you, and that's why I have authority over you. Whereas in the Christian tradition, no. You have that role, but we are both equal before God. Okay, that's the first principle. Second principle for those who have authority is that authority is always for service. Now, if you want to take a note here, just jot down in your margin, Mark 10. Jesus, the apostles got into a debate about who was the greatest. And so Jesus took them aside, and he said to them, you know how those who have authority among the Gentiles lord it over people under them. Their great ones make their importance felt. I am somebody. You better heed me, because I have power over you. So, but Jesus says to them, it cannot be this way with you. The one among you who is the greatest is the servant of all. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. So why is there authority, or what is the purpose of authority in the Christian tradition? We've talked about this before, I know, in this class as well. Authority is always so that we may serve. Okay? Take a teacher in a classroom. She has authority. She needs to have authority. But not to lord it over those kids and, you know, talk down to them as though they were just nothing and she was everything. But rather, she has authority so that she can serve them. She needs to be able to maintain order. She needs to be able to set an agenda, move in a certain direction with them. So she needs authority. And she has authority, but she does it so that she can serve them. So it should be exercised with humility, with a spirit of loving service and reverence for the ones who are served, and so on. So hopefully I, as your pastor, you know, try to, you know, again, try to have a kind of a sense of that, you know, that I'm here to serve you. And that ultimately, my main role here is to be the servant of all, not just to make decisions and have my will enacted. Okay, so. All right, so you see the difference, right? Now, pray for me. Okay. All right, but in the end, the idea is the ideal vision for authority in the Christian tradition is if you have it, and most of us do to some degree, in some way or another, is that we have it. First of all, we exercise it toward people who are our equal. There may be a subordinate role in terms of functionality in a corporation, but at a personal, interpersonal level, we're all equal before God. So that's the first principle. Second principle, authority is always for service. Service. Okay? And this Thursday night, tomorrow night, we're going to see that the foot washing is a symbol of that type of thinking, that Jesus is the Lord. He is the one who has authority over all the church, but he washes the feet of the disciples. Okay? So that's all kind of in the background of a text like this for us as Christians, that we hear this and we think immediately of Jesus, what he said in Mark 10. We think about the type of respect that authorities among equals and so on. All right? Comments or questions or rebuttals or about this? Okay. Again, not always easy to do, but it's the basic principles. Yes, sir.
I did see a connection with the verse about livestock.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
I kind of substituted the word pets in there?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a pet, look after it.
Yeah.
I think the real message across all these verses for me is that we need to strive to have proper relationships with everything that God puts in his
world. Yes.
We can have a relationship with him.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I kind of overlooked the livestock one, but you're right. I think it's interesting. I think probably much more than at the time this text like this was written, we have kind of developed a little bit more of an understanding that animals are maybe more sentient than we, you know, they're not just brute animals. And, you know, we tend to have more experience with pets than they did in the ancient world. They didn't have time for pets like we do, you know. But I just know you and my little cat, Daniel, you know, he's to be cared for. He's part of God's creatures and creation. And I shouldn't, every now and then I like to tease him, but I have to be careful there because I don't want to break his spirit, so to speak. And, but it's interesting because you can even begin to learn with the animals in your life how to treat. I find it remarkable that some people are much better to their animals than they are to their fellow human travelers. And, but we can at least begin to see that as a kind of a learning thing that we learn to respect or treat with kindness, not to use cruelty or harshness when it's not necessary. Yeah.
And even if you put it in the context of its historical time, livestock was seen as people's livelihood.
Yeah.
So
you drive your livestock, they might die.
Exactly. So it's also in terms of not necessarily an animal, but just mm-hmm. you know, being
mm-hmm.
you know, observant about your job and your whatever your livelihood may be.
Right. Mm-hmm. So again, yeah, I mean, we all take care of our cars for that weird reason today. I mean, you know, if we don't take care of our car, it'll eventually break down and we'll be without any transportation. So, I mean, I don't mean to be completely mechanistic about it, but the same, for them, you're right, they depended on their animals. And they need to take good care of them, not drive them. You know, it's interesting that even the Sabbath rules even apply to animals. You weren't to work or run your animals on the Sabbath. And the whole concept that every human person needs rest, but so do every living thing needs a period of rest. This seems to be built into creation and into nature. And it just seems that rest is an essential component for at least every mammal, probably even bugs and other things that we're not as observant about their life.
I think that there's some kind of problem with people thinking fear is the same as respect.
Mm-hmm.
And as a teacher, I saw that often.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That they would, literally, one mother came in to feed her daughter,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't let her.
Yeah, right.
And to me, there was a real mistake right here. There was something that wasn't transferred correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what always worked for me as a teacher is giving respect to the students, because even if they never had it at home or understood it at home, they started understanding when they were given respect.
Yeah. My own experience as having been, we all had the experience of having fear inflicted on us. And my experience about fear as a motivator is that it lasts about 20 minutes. And then I begin to just get resentful. I mean, when I say 20 minutes, I'm putting that in quotes, but it's not a long-lasting strategy. So if somebody, you know, tries to motivate me with just fear, I eventually just become resentful. And I begin to become, even if I can't directly withstand them, I tend to become passive-aggressive and avoidant, and I just basically do the bare minimum. You know what I mean? But I think we use this expression passive aggressive, but I don't know that everybody's always clear what it means. But an example of passive aggressive, maybe the classic example, is somebody starting to tailgate you, And what do? You slow down. You're not stepping out of your car and punching them in the nose. That's aggression. You're not giving them the middle finger. And that's, at least literally. pardon that expression, but you're not doing something overtly hostile or violent. But you're being aggressive, but in a passive way, basically by dragging your feet. Well, I'll show you. You said I better be at this meeting or else. Fine. I'll show up late. I won't participate. And I'll need to leave early. And we don't even always do this consciously. But, when you're motivated to be there or else, and you better. Again, occasionally that just every now and then we need to use that kind of or else. At least in the workplace, occasionally that's necessary. But in the end, it doesn't really last long as a good motivator. I think that's part of what you're getting at. I'm just sort of going a little further down the road with it. But I that's my experience. Somebody tries to dominate me with fear. 20 minutes later, I'm starting to resent it. And, I just become uncooperative eventually. And I'm not even sure I'm always doing it consciously. But I just start to shut down. Because, anyway, that's kind of the idea. But, this is all very, I think, basic good stuff. And it's the same, by the way, with preaching. I find that sometimes I have to use fear to get people's attention and motivate them. But if all I ever did was warn about hell, I don't think we do enough of that today, because I think it's all, everything's fine and there's no consequences. That doesn't really motivate. That's the other extreme, right? But if all we do is warn about hell and punishment from God, then we're in a little bit of trouble, because, again, that's not a long-lasting motivator. It may work for a little while. But the idea is that we're supposed to grow away from fear and simply begin to love God and do it simply because we love God and know that He loves us. And so the idea in our life is to move away, as Jesus says, perfect love cast out fear, cast out all fear. We're more motivated by love to do what is right. At first, though, sometimes we just need that motivator. Boy, God, there are consequences to this bad behavior and you need to be sober about it. And by God, you better look at it. But that's kind of a preliminary. It's not the end game. You don't want to just keep a person locked in fear, because frankly, I find it doesn't usually work in the long run. Eventually, people just say, "Well," and they just kind of give up, because the human psyche is only, you can only focus on negative emotions for so long, and then the psyche just kind of gets worn out, and you got to go on to something else. Anyway, but again, please understand what I'm saying. The pedagogy sometimes is we need a little bit of both, but be careful that you don't simply try to fear, just use fear as your only motivator. And especially in workplaces and about stuff, be very, very careful. And same with children. Eventually they just shut down, So, all right. What's that?
Fear out of respect?
Yeah, I think that we use the word fear not just as an either or, all or nothing kind of word. There's degrees of it. We talk about, like in Scripture, the fear of the Lord, which basically there means more reverence, respect, loving reverence for God. Whereas the other extreme of fear is, you're cowering in the corner waiting to get close. And so sometimes we use the word fear in different ways, and there's different degrees of fear. Generally, in our culture, my sense is in America, and you all can disagree with me, but we tend to use the word fear only to mean the negative, kind of other extreme. Whereas in the Bible, as the fear of the Lord is a common expression. We've talked about it before. And it has a more positive type of dimension. But I think generally in modern American English language, most people almost never use fear the way the Bible does. So we have to be careful.
What I keep calling
the
respect
for parents is
a given.
Yeah.
And out of that,
the
fear comes.
Right.
Out of
respect,
that's why
I think. Yeah.
Following the tradition
of the custom. Right. And again, I was more or less talking just a moment ago, though, about generally in English we mean by fear the unhealthy or unhelpful kind of fear, not the reverential fear that is good and is commended in Scripture. We just have to be careful. We mean different things by fear. Okay. Now, we have here next regarding sons and daughters. If you have sons, chastise them. Bend their necks from childhood. If you have daughters, keep them chaste and be not indulgent to them. How far do I go? Let's see, verse 25. Give your daughter in marriage. Giving your daughter in marriage ends a great task, but give her to a worthy man. Okay. Now, you might say some of this is sort of dated, blah, blah, blah. But, again, notice here what it says. We don't like in modern English any notion of punishment or chastisement. But in the end, I hope that we've kind of, I think, come to a point where we realize if we don't learn to discipline children when they're very young and set limits and in a loving way, but insist on boundaries, it just gets out of control the further down the road you get. It just gets worse and worse, and bad habits and just really, really bad situations. So, and the thing here too is, you were mentioning the experience of teaching, and I know some others in the room have been teaching and in teaching situations. Let me just say an experience that I've had as a priest. Just to kind of show you maybe the idea here of disciplining but with love and with a kind of a self-controlled authority. Because disciplining and punishing is not yelling and screaming and basically melting down with the kid and just shouting louder and threatening and so on. But rather, it seems to me that the kind of discipline that is called for here and is probably the most effective is, here's an example. I would go into a classroom and the kids were being loud and talking. And the teacher would talk louder and say, "Quiet, class!" She'd raise her voice over their voice and try to outshout them. And of course, then they would just begin to get louder. And so what I was taught to do, now I was never really a formally trained teacher, but I did have some training, was that when that kind of a situation comes, there's a lot of noise and clutter and stuff going on, begin to lower your voice and begin to, you start to draw them in a little bit and the volume begins to drop. And when they're all being frantic and going like this, stay calm, collected. Instead of being frantic yourself and being as agitated. In other words, don't get into their space and be where they are. Be in your own lane. Stay in your lane. Have authority over your own stuff. Be in your own space and draw them toward you. As one who is not easily unsettled, don't have lots of buttons out for them to push. I can get her by saying this, or I know it'll get her upset, I'll do that. And again, this isn't even always conscious that kids do this. I mean, they're not going to say, "I know what I'm going to do, I'm going to..." But they just sort of learn this sort of stuff. And rather than when it says here to chastise sons and bend their necks from childhood, this isn't some kind of an unloving thing here, but it's just a very... I am the adult. I have authority. I'm calling the shots. But Mom, but Dad! Let me repeat what I just said. I am the adult. I have the authority. I am calling the shots. Now, and again, without getting worked up about it and getting into a power struggle with a child, for heaven's sakes. But unfortunately, because we're going on now, as I said, maybe the third or fourth generation where this hasn't been well taught or well modeled. Many people my age and younger who are raising kids, and a lot of my friends in school already have grandkids, instead of having authority, it's a power struggle with the kids. And it's shouting and pushing and threatening and cajoling, rather than simply saying, "Now look, if you do not clean your room within an hour, you'll stay in here for the next 2 days." "But Mom, I said what I mean." And then you have to be willing to actually do the punishment. You're not just giving empty threats. You simply say, "I said what I mean, and I mean what I say. I didn't say it mean, but I mean what I say, and I say what I mean. I'm not going to raise my voice. I'm not going to get into an argument with you. I am the adult. You are the child. I have given you a perfectly legitimate request to clean your room. Within the hour, it should be done. And if it is not, you will be confined for the next 2 days. You will not be going out. You will not be in the video games. You will not have any of these privileges." It's just as simple as that. Now, again, I know that there's actually now, some of these agencies that actually teach some of these skills today. But the point, I think, is that this is not shout and scream and have a power struggle and really assault these kids and yell and scream at them. That's not what it means when it says chastise or give them extreme punishments, but just sure, swift punishments. And so once again, my own experience as doing some teaching is that I would simply say to the kids, now look, if you don't settle down and finish your, you know, finish what I've told you to do, every one of you will be writing the Our Father in Latin 5 times tonight. And then when they start to protest, they did 10 times. I'm not going to relinquish authority to you. I have it, and I will use it with love, but I will not play games with you. Now, again, a very calm, firm, but loving disposition. Now, hopefully, again, after a while, you have to, you know, they pick up on you really mean what you say, and they begin to fall in the line. But the problem is that we're so easily swayed, or we say we're going to punish, but we really don't, because frankly, it's too much trouble to punish. Now, example, I was reading an article on this some weeks ago. A mother had a 2-year-old daughter who was in meltdown at the local Safeway. And she said that, you know, she said, I knew that from my training, the way I had to handle this was to say to her that if you don't stop that right now, we're going home and you're going to go to bed. And her daughter didn't stop. And so she took her by the hand and very calmly led her to the car, leaving her grocery basket that was already half filled right there in the store, and took her daughter home and put her in her room. Now, that was a great inconvenience to the mother. You know, she was trying to shop. She had, so in other words, it cost her something to do this discipline. See, and sometimes I'm afraid that we're not always willing to pay the price. In other words, it means that we may have to, if we're going to, you know, do a punishment. Sometimes it means that we're going to just have to, you know, supervise when they're home, or, you know, we're going to have to be a little closer in the way we watch them. And again, I think that's part of the problem of being consistent with discipline. And again, another aspect of it, of course, is you have 2 working parents instead of a, you know, stay-at-home mom or someone like that who's, you know, really devoted to this 100% of the time. And so there's a lot of contributing factors, but my sense is that when you hear a text like this, don't just think of the way a lot of people do it today, which is yelling and screaming and threatening and even corporal punishment. I think a little corporal punishment is sometimes a swat on the tush or something. Personally, I think it's probably called for, especially with the young kids from time to time. Rarely, but important. But fundamentally, just a very serene countenance. Clear, you're in touch with your own authority, you're willing to use it, you're willing to be a little inconvenienced, and you'll apply the punishments when necessary in a loving but judicious manner, but you're firm, you're swift, you're clear, and you're unbending. And the kids begin to pick up on it after a while, and they know they can't manipulate you anymore, they can't push buttons, and they can't get you to do their will. That's when I think we've kind of recaptured what a text like this is calling for. It says, bend their necks. It means, you know, keep them under proper authority. Yes, Nancy.
Now, Father, from the way some of us learned authority from our elders, it wasn't learned that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how far back, and I'm not saying we've ever done authority perfectly in any culture at any time, but those are just some of the things that my own reflection would lead me to. Now, some of you may have different experiences, and I did too. My father could scare the heck out of me. I mean, I'll tell you, I was afraid of my father. And by the way, I resented him. I mean, but in the end, I think I'd rather almost have come through that kind of a system than this, oh, well, we don't want to upset Charlie's little ego, and I would have become completely incorrigible. So, I mean, I still will say that I could personally probably make a few improvements on the way my parents did it. But, you know, hey, they were human. They did the best they could. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I'm feeling the foreigners right now. The mother tells me, oh, she's in control of the house. And she takes it upon herself in our classroom to run around. Because we're not going to deal with that in here. And one of my assistants says, well, I'm going to call her father. She says, call him. Because she knows that the father, I mean, she's running the household.
Yeah,
We're dealing with a four-year-old.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that it takes a lot of self-discipline to do discipline well. when it comes to children, because, hey, they'll wait you out. They will wait you out. And they're not, they got a lot more energy, and they have a lot more time on their hands. And so I'm just trying to say that, I'm not trying to say I've got some sage wisdom, because most of you have raised kids, you're more into understanding these things than I am, but I'm just trying to tell you a few of the things I've learned from some of the training I've gotten, in terms of doing some classroom teaching and all, but in the end, I know that we all have our own personalities, and we all have some techniques and things that work better for us than for others, so I'm not trying to say, hey, I've got this figured out, just come to me if you have a parenting question. I've never been a parent. But I was certainly under parents, and so that's where I'm offering these things. But my sense again is just stay in your lane, stay in your space. Don't let a child get into a power struggle with you, because that's completely inappropriate. You are the adult; they are the child. Just have a serenity about the fact that you have authority. Use it with love, but use it. And I think we've got to recover a sense of this, because I think the biggest problem with authority today is not usually those who are under authority, but those who are over and will not use their authority properly. Okay. So, and I'm not saying that we have to be severe, but just firm but kind. Firm but kind. Anyway, well, such sage advice from a priest who's never raised kids. Father, you don't know what it's like. Well, you're right. Now, it says here again regarding daughters, notice it's there to singles them out for to be chaste. It doesn't mention chastity for the young men. And so I think we just have to accept that, well, first of all, chastity was more important. Stay with me in this. I'm going to say something that's going to sound like it may upset you for a minute. But let me just stay with me for a minute. Chastity, in a certain sense, is more important for a young woman than for a young man. Now, don't get me wrong. Both are commanded to remain chaste till marriage. But a young woman has much more to suffer if she's unchaste. And that's true even in today's egalitarian, theoretically egalitarian, women's lib era. I'm sorry. If there's sexual activity, the woman has a lot more to lose. She just does. The man can have that encounter and walk away and hardly think of it. She may be pregnant. She may have an STD. Now, he may get one of those too, but again, she's much more vulnerable to those things. There's frequently in our culture, despite all of our enlightened and how women's live, all that stuff, frankly, most young men who impregnate women are not around to be found. They're not financially held accountable. It's just too much. So in other words, part of the reason for this type of advice being emphasized for the young lady is that she has more to lose. Now, especially in that culture, if a young woman was found to not be a virgin, she in effect might just end up a beggar on the streets, because no man would have her. And the only way you had social security in those days, if you were a woman, is if you had a husband or a brother who was watching out, or a father who was watching out for you. Because otherwise, you didn't work, you didn't have any livelihood. The only way you had any connection to, you know, the resources you needed was through a man. And the man insisted that when a woman married, she'd be a virgin. And if she was found not to be a virgin, and I don't need to go through all the stories, they wanted to actually have the linens from the bedchamber, from the honeymoon, to prove that she had in fact been a virgin. This was very common in that culture. So again, that's an additional thing that isn't common today in our culture, but back then it was, and so she has more to lose. Now, he can go into, no one's going to find out whether he was a virgin or not. Just the way things are. Now you say, well, it's not fair. Well, I'm just saying that's the way it was, and that's the way it is, and a woman has more to lose. Now, maybe it shouldn't be that way, but I'm just saying it is. And so I think there's some sense that particularly we should absolutely preach a chastity to both young men and young women equally. But I do think, though, that it isn't inappropriate to say to a young woman, you have more to lose, my dear. You know, because unfortunately, men often get away with unchastity, but a woman doesn't as easily get. And even if she, like our culture says today, run off and get an abortion, I'm telling you, I have picked up the pieces from women who've had abortions. I mean, they're shattered emotionally. They struggle with guilt, with sorrow. I'm sorry. It's just not. It's not like any medical procedure. Apparently, a lot of the women I've had to counsel over the years have had some very tough roads to hoe, you know, in the aftermath of an abortion. So don't hold that up as some kind of a solution. Obviously, it would be considered immoral from our Christian perspective. But even if you want to just set the immorality aside, that is not another way that somehow the playing ground is leveled. It is not. It is not. Okay. Again, just take it for what it's worth. This is good practical advice. Now, but let me say a word of to kind of bring it into the room, or maybe not in the room, but into the parish. One of the things I've been having some discussions with some of the women leaders, and also with the men leaders in the Holy Name Society, and in the mainly among the youth, the women youth leaders, we have got to do, I think, a better job speaking about these things to young people, both the men, the young men, and the young women. I'm not going to get into details, but let's just say that I'm aware right now of two young women in the parish who are well underage or unmarried, who are pregnant. The husband's, there is no husband. The young man, the father, is not in the picture, and the pattern just keeps repeating. Now, we cannot just allow this to go uncommented upon. We have to. And so part of the mission after Easter is that I'm going to be gathering with some of the leaders who are women and some of the leaders who are men and begin to develop a strategy where we rather systematically take the young men and women, first of all separately, but even together in appropriate ways, where we really discuss these things. And it would be my job, especially as pastor, to speak about the biblical morality. The Bible's very clear about these things. And then for the parents, the women and the men, to begin to speak from practical experience and so on. So this is a very serious issue in our culture in America today, and we need to not, shall we say, have a church full of young people and not have them know very explicitly from us as a Christian community what is appropriate, what is not, what are the dangers, what are the concerns. Not just do it because we say so, but explaining to them why it makes sense, and so on. So this is underway. This is underway. And clearly it can't just be the young women we talk to. It has to be the young men, and it has to be insisted upon by us. Okay? So pray about that. And another funny little story. Sometimes people expect the pastor to do things that the pastor has really no business doing. I was at St. Mary's in Laurel, and a woman came up to me and she says, "Father," she said, "look across the street there. There's a high school across the street called Pilate High School, with a Catholic school." And the girls used to hike up their skirts, roll them up, and they'd be almost like mini skirts, They'd roll them up so high. "Father, you've got to go tell those young girls," she said to me, this woman, "you've got to go tell those young girls that they've got to lower their skirts." And I said, "Now look, we were right in the thick of this clergy sex abuse scandal, okay? Are you crazy?" And so I said to her, I said, "Ma'am," I said, "you are a woman. You are old enough to be a matriarch. That is your job. All right? You go talk to these young women. You tell them your experience. Talk. Oh, well, Father, I can't do that. I mean, isn't that the problem today?" Mm-hmm. See? Talk to your kids about sex. Everybody else is. So we've got to kind of overcome this, leave it to Father or leave it to Sister. They'll do the chastity talk. Come on, it's just, again, we're all in this, right? I got to do my part, don't get me wrong. I did give sermons, to the high school students about these things, but for me to go up to an individual young lady and say, "well..."
And maybe you can have some guest speakers come in, that are younger, and you can tell them that it's cool to be virgin. I've taken my son to a program where he was football players and basketball players, and they spoke about, being virgin, and he was like,
you know, I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So it made him think. Right. Well, good. And if you have any names to suggest, I mean, we're beginning to, after Easter, we're going to begin to sit down and begin to look at, you know, all of these things. So if you have some names you can suggest to me offline, that'd be great. Okay. All right. Then let's move on. We have here it talks about giving the daughter in marriage ending a great task, but to give her to a worthy man. Remember in those days, in fact, frankly, until very recent times, marriages were always arranged. You say, oh, that's so unfair, that's so harsh, it's terrible. Romeo, what about Romeo and Juliet? And, you know, they committed suicide rather than go into the arranged marriages. And, you know, yeah, there were these types of issues that came up. But generally speaking, it hasn't really been until about the last 200 years that marriage became the sort of free will go out on the range and look and find yourself a spouse. It was almost always, up until about 200 years ago, that marriages were almost always arranged. You just did that. Now, I know there's a lot of strong feelings about that. I'm just going to tell you that's just the way things were. Yes, ma'am.
It's interesting you say that because now there's all those commercials for, you know, these, like, harmony.
Yeah, right. Where it's like, matchmakers, you know, basically.
Yeah, leading it to somebody else to arrange it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah. There's a lot of stress in dating. There just is. I mean, you know, gosh, I remember that well. You'd have some pretty thick skin if you wanted to have your girl out. Too much of laugh in your face. She said, dream on. All right. Well, anyway, yeah, but anyway, the... but it's interesting when you look at... divorce statistics and the way people spoke about marriage in these old days when things were arranged, and you'd think, oh, it's dismal, it's awful. And but generally, people spoke rather just as highly about marriage then as they did. And they had the romance was a notion. And what happened was, you know, they were generally very young when they were paired up, you know, probably, 13, 14. And by the time they were 15, they were married and starting to have kids. And, remember the Fiddler on the Roof? And, you know, that was the time of arranged marriages, you know, it's referring to that time, but I've grown accustomed to her face. You know, you just kind of, you sort of grow old together and you just sort of get accustomed and you just adjust. And, you know, we have this idea, it's got to be romance and physical attraction. And that is not necessarily the best basis for a marriage. Now, sadly, among the more affluent in those days, they would have their wife and, you know, they have a mistress on the side for real sexual pleasure. I mean, so in other words, I'm not trying to say there wasn't some of this, bad stuff going on. But generally speaking, it was a system that was pretty much in up until about 200 years ago, pretty much all throughout the world. It seemed to have worked pretty well. And because it wasn't just two people getting married, it was two families. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that a marriage was pretty an extension of a wider family structure. And, look at our situation today with all the divorce and the promiscuity and all the stuff you would think. Now that, they're really in love and they only marry the person they love, and now they'll stay faithful and they'll be happy and everything will be fine. And, well, look at it. You know, it doesn't turn out that way, does it? Does it? So, Without saying, hey, I'm not trying to say we should go back to that. I don't think we could go back. You can't unring the bell. So we're in a different situation. But I just want to let's not look down our nose at this old system and think, oh, unfair, how terrible, how it worked. It wasn't that bad, and generally people accepted it just the way things were.
We were talking in the office the other day, and one of the things that was saying is that, for single people today, with all the extended family that people have now, you almost have to check a person's family background to make sure you aren't marrying a relative.
Yeah. Right. Well, anyway, that's it. So again, you're right. It's a lot of moving around. Okay. Well, here we are now. Moving on. Regarding a spouse, if you have a wife, let her not seem odious to you, but where there is ill feeling, trust her not. Now, this is a tough line. And remember, this book is written by men for younger men. Now, what it is a call to sobriety. Now, first of all, the positive advice is, look, don't give in to negative feelings about your wife. That's basically what it's saying here. It says, if you have a wife, don't let her become odious to you. How does it put it? Let her not seem odious to you. You know, look, you and I have a choice in life. We can give way to negative feelings and they grow. What you feed grows. Remember the old saying? If you want to feed into negative emotions and start taking a book on somebody, she doesn't do this and she doesn't... If you want to do that, you're heading down a path and she's going to start hating her. Okay. You're going to keep a book, every little thing you're going to nitpick, and you're going to just basically let the negative feelings grow. Now, you say, well, I can't help my feelings. Yes, you can. I mean, maybe not directly, but what you feed grows. So, again, I've never been married, so, hey, but I've done a lot of marriage counseling. And you know, every now and then a couple comes in. And I mean, literally, they sit on that sofa up there, hitting on each other.
Oh.
I mean, literally fist fighting, but I mean, oh, stop that, you know that's not true, you know. And you know, I remember there was one couple, and they were yelling, and I had to go out and reassure the secretary that it's okay. We're working it out. But, I mean, they were literally yelling, and I said to him, you know, there was a time when you used to worship the ground she walked on, because I had prepared them for marriage, you know, some 15 years ago. And I remember they were in love, and the dress, and the wedding, and the, you know, and they hired a violinist and everything. And I remember that, and I said, now what happened? He said, a lot's happened, Father. But again, look, a one-sided pancake is pretty thin. So I'm not saying it's one person's fault or the other. I'm just going to say that we tend to keep a book and pile up the negative emotions and pick away at them and count them. And by God, we have every grievance counted. But do we have every blessing counted? No way. That's just, oh yeah, she's okay occasionally, you know, blah, blah, blah. There are a few things I like about her. But these other things. And I said to her, what is it? Said, tell me one thing about your husband that you like. Well, you know, he really is a good father. He's great with the kids. I said, you know, now that is a very good man to have around. See, you know, he's not ignoring the kids. He loves the kids. You know, so in other words, you see what I'm saying? It's so easy for us. Again, look, you have me for your pastor. So there are things about me you like. There are things about me you wish were different. Don't tell me out loud.
We have
others. But you can choose what to focus on. No, but the point is that, you see, we are, yeah, there you go. Yeah. How many verses have we gotten through? But in the end, you have a choice to make, don't you, in life? You can take the bad with the good and the good with the bad. You can insist on perfection. Many people want their marriage to be an ideal. If it becomes an ordeal, they want to go for a new deal. And the problem is they want their marriage to be ideal, right? And stop that. Your marriage is not ideal because you're in it. Hello? Your marriage is not perfect because you're in it. That's where to start. And then stop. So this text is basically saying to husbands, look, man, stop keeping a book on your wife. Don't let her seem odious to you. Don't let all that negative stuff grow. Try to think about the positive things about your wife, you see? Things you love about her, see? I'm reading into it a little bit, but that's the basic idea. Now then, though, there is a call to sobriety here. It simply says here, be careful. If you have a wife, let her not seem odious to you, but where there is ill feeling, don't trust her. Now, what it's basically saying, you know, the old saying, you know, hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned, and so on. But basically, remember, I know this is not a politically correct statement, but remember, it's written by older men to younger men. Basically, be careful. If your wife is becoming hateful to you, be very, very scared. Be very, very careful. Because women have, we like to hold that women have no power, especially in ancient cultures, but women had a lot of power. They could influence the kids, they could influence the grandkids, they could influence your brother-in-law. Listen, don't play games. That's what this text is saying. Be very, very careful. Because although we like to think, oh, women have so many rights today, in the old days they had no rights whatsoever. Well, but you know that even in homes that are very traditional, the wife and the mother has a lot of practical authority. And if a husband's smart, he defers to a lot of it. Yes, dear. The honey-do list, yes, dear, comes out. But women do, even in the most suppressed cultures, women have a lot of practical authority. Okay, again, let me just say it again. They can influence the kids. They can influence their brother, your brother-in-law. They can influence, you know, in other words, they have, because they're the heart of the family. And a lot of feeling is stored there. And a lot of really basic practical authority is there. Even if there's some sort of a patina that the men are in charge. I mean, again, it's not that simple. It's just not that simple. So I think that's how to interpret this text. It's just, men, sober up. If your wife is angry with you, and I'm not just talking about, you know, a little passing argument, but I mean, there's a real serious, be very sober about this, and don't take it lightly, because it can cause a lot of harm. And then it's kind of back to the first advice. Don't let her be odious to you. Repair the damage. Now, I don't have the time to go through a whole theology of marriage, but when Adam's marriage was in trouble, and Adam and Eve's marriage was falling apart, what did God say? He didn't say, Adam and Eve, where are you? He said, Adam, where are you? So men, men need to do a better job about being less passive. Too many men are passive husbands and passive fathers. They're not going to lift a finger to solve a problem in their family. They wait. It's the wife who drags the husband to marriage counseling. It should not be that way. It's the husband who is supposed to cling to his wife. Got it? And unfortunately, it's usually the wife who ends up trying to keep the marriage glued together. And it's backwards. See? And likewise, there's too much passive fathering going on. Sitting on the sofa, flipping open a beer, the kids are running crazy. Dear, would you get those kids to calm down? I can't hear the game. Okay. So, again, well, let's move on. Regarding our parents, with your whole heart, honor your father. Did you hear that? Your whole heart. Not just, I have to honor him. It's Father's Day, I better call him. Hi, Dad. Hi, son. Boy, I hate his guts. He was so mean to me growing up. Ah, I hate him. You know. Hi, Dad. Hi, son. See you later, Dad. Click. You know. I mean, with your whole heart, honor your father. And you say, this is not possible. My father was this or that. Pray for a miracle. Pray for a miracle. God can do it. Now, again, honor here doesn't just mean showing respect, but in the end, honor also means take care of them in their old age. It means provide for their basic needs where necessary as they get older, and so on. Okay? So, this is, with your whole heart, honor your father. Your mother's birth pangs, do not forget. Okay? Oh, hello? You know? I mean, and don't just think of the birth pangs, but I think of all the things my mother had to put up with just to raise me. I mean, I gave my mother a lot of trouble. She said I didn't stop crying for the first 6 months. I had colic or something like that. She said that, again, you know, I was very temperamental. I tended to always wake up around 2 in the morning and need, you know, feeding and so on. I mean, all the sleepless nights, I think of all the time my mother opened up her purse and pulled out money and threw it at me, you know, here, you need another pair of shoes, all right, here, you know. And I think of all the things my parents went without so that I could go to college. And I mean, just all those are birth pangs too, right? It's not just the pain of coming through the birth canal. It's the pain of raising you. It's have love. It's just love. I mean, well, we're all great on Mother's Day. But don't ever forget your mother's birth pangs, okay? Have a deep, deep love for her. And I know that we all have complicated relations with both our parents, our mothers. It can be a complicated relationship. I know that. But in the end, a deep affection and love for all the sacrifices is very essential. Now, it goes on to say here, remember the parents of these parents you were born. What can you ever give them for all they gave you? So, and some of us have noted as we've gotten older, I only had a brief time with my father. He was really quite ill for the last 6 months of his life. My mother died very suddenly, but some of you have had even longer experiences, and in some sense there is a great return, isn't there, as we care for our parents in their old age. It's amazing how there's a kind of a complete role reversal, you know. And sometimes we actually literally have to spoon feed our parents in their old age, and we have to take care of them like they took care of us. We have to carry them, put them in bed. You know, just it's amazing. So just be aware that there's a social reason for these types of commandments beyond simply the fact that God commands them. I mean, how will, and remember in those days they didn't have Social Security and nursing homes. You took care of your parents in your own home. That's what you did. You say, well, yeah, but people died earlier then. Well, yes, sometimes, but sometimes not. So again, in the end, these are the things that are done. All right, and then on the next section, again, just a short section, regarding the priest. They say, well, they had priests in the Old Testament? Yes, they did. They had priests. They weren't Roman Catholic priests. They didn't wear Roman collars, but they ran the temple. And the priest depended, because they had no... the priest depended on the tithe. Because this is how they didn't have any land. The priest from the tribe of Levi received no ancestral inheritance. That's to say, they had no land, which was really the source of wealth in the Old Testament, and therefore they had to depend on the people paying them a tithe or a tenth of the produce. And generally in that economy, it wasn't cash. There wasn't a lot of cash going around. It was more of a barter economy. So literally, you brought animals to the temple, a tenth of your flock, a tenth of your crops, a tenth of whatever. And the priests lived off, literally lived. That's why they said that they often refer to the temple as the storehouse. Remember that from the Malachi text we preach out of every year, you know. Let there be meat in mine house, saith the Lord of hosts. Bring ye the whole tithe into the storehouse. The tithe, the tenth. So this is what is due to the priest. So it says here simply this: with all your soul, fear God. Properly understood, Mr. G, what we were just saying with understood as a healthy fear here, but a deep reverence for God. Revere His priest. With all your strength, love your Creator, and forsake not His ministers. Okay, honor God, respect the priest, give him his portion as you have been commanded. First fruits, contributions, due sacrifices, and holy offerings. Okay, so here we have a basic Old Testament equivalent of what we need today. Now, I, as you know, don't have any other job. This is it right here. I depend on your being faithful, and you are. This congregation is enormously faithful to God in the tithe, and I'm really grateful, because I not only have to provide, you know, for my own income as far as like food and so on, but I have to make sure the buildings are in repair, and so it isn't just for me personally that you're giving the tithe, but to keep God's house in good order and good repair, so that it doesn't all start to fall down and we lose the beautiful buildings we've had. So you're a very, very faithful congregation, and I praise God for you every day, and I thank God. And God told me many years ago that if I would really be faithful and preach His message of tithing, that I would not be rolling in dough, which is not even appropriate for a church, but I would always have enough to take care of what needed to be done. And He's never let me down yet. I've been preaching the tithe for almost 20 years, and I've never been in the red. As a pastor, never been in the red, but even as an associate, when I was here with you the first go-round, as soon as Father T and I got started with tithing, God turned this place around. And so again, I thank God for every one of you. I thank God for His message. It's a very simple message. Give one-tenth of your income back to God's house. God will also, therefore, reward every one of you who are faithful to the tithe. So this is a basic understanding here. Yeah, take care of the priests, because they're God's ministers. They're taking care. Now, you say, well, okay, there have been problems with priests embezzling money. Yes, there are always. Today is Spy Wednesday. Spy Wednesday is the day when Judas handed Jesus over, or conspired to hand Jesus over. It actually takes place tomorrow in the evening when Jesus is arrested in the garden. But this is the day that tradition ascribes to Judas actually working out an arrangement and getting paid to hand Jesus over. So he was one of the first priests of the new covenant, you know, the call of the apostles. So some priests go bad. Now, I'm not excusing it. I'm not trying to make light of it. It's a horrible thing. But I'm just saying that we have to sometimes expect and understand that anytime you've got collection of any human beings, I don't care what their office, you're going to find there's some problems that arise. The vast majority of priests I know are faithful. They don't embezzle money. They're living properly, celibate lives. They're everything. But there are a small number of priests that go bad. And so I just put that out before you today on Spy Wednesday. when one of the priests, and you say, well, we need to really firm up the, we need to be careful about who we let into the seminaries. We need to do all that. Absolutely. We need to do psychological testing. We need to watch them for 5 years at least of formation. We need to make sure they're men of God, who love God, who love God's people, who are men of the church. We need to do all that. But even Jesus, who I think probably is the best searcher of hearts, even he had one priest that was bad. Right? So I can't say there's ever going to be a foolproof method that will ever be able to guarantee that every one of the priests who serves you is always going to be holy and never ever do anything wrong. I can't guarantee it. I'm just going to tell you, though, take care of God's priests. Pray for us. They're God. Generally speaking, we're all God's ministers. And some of us, very few of us, thank God, but some of us go bad. And pray that we have a proper way to deal with that in the church. Okay. All right. Now, then, regarding the poor, verse 32. To the poor also extend your hand, that your blessings may be complete. All right. Notice again, extend your hand, that your blessing may be complete. So, Jesus says, given it will be given unto you. Book of Ecclesiastes says, cast your bread in the water, it will come back to you after many days. You ever try that? Throw a leaf out in the pond or something that'll float, and the rings bring it right back to the shore. You ever notice that? That's the vision of Ecclesiastes 11, verse 1. It says, cast your bread in the water, it will come back to you after many days. So it sets up these little rings in the pond, and they bring it right back to shore. That's the vision. Okay, so the idea is when you bless the poor, God will not be outdone in generosity. And I don't know, I've had a very common experience with, and many people tell me they've had the same experience, that when they've given, God always sort of gives back. It always comes back. And very often, literally in the form of money. anyway, it's amazing the way that works. So in other words, you want your blessings to be complete? Well, then extend your hand to the poor. All right. Again, we've talked about there's a lot of problems of just handing out money on the street corners. That may not be the best way here, but are you noted for your goodness to charity? That really can maybe systematically help the poor. All right. So we have decisions to make. We can't give away everything, and it's not always appropriate to just give to every beggar who comes up, on the street corner. I understand that. It's complicated, but in the end, you make sure that you're generous to the poor. Okay. All right, then, pity towards the mourning and the sick. Be generous to all the living, and do not withhold your kindness from the dead. Now, I preached on this a few weeks ago in the announcement time. Well, we really have an obligation to pray for the dead. And this was a Jewish tradition. To the Protestants who say there's no point in praying for the dead, I would simply say, well, if Jesus had anything against it, he would have railed against it, because it was a common thing in the Jewish world that when somebody died, you prayed for them. See, that they be, quote, loosed from their sins. Now, Jesus, had he said something against that, would have railed against it, but he did not. We see it in the book of Maccabees, where Judas Maccabeus took up an offering for the dead soldiers who had committed some sins, that they be loosed of their sins. He sent for that sacrificial offering to the temple to be offered in their honor, so that, again, they would, quote, be loosed from their sins. Here we see, again, another reference, don't withhold your kindness from the dead. And that doesn't just mean bury their bodies, it means pray for them. Okay, so we do that. It says here not to avoid those who weep, to mourn with those who mourn, not to neglect to visit the sick. And we all want to just sort of do happy things all day, right? I think St. John Chrysostom was noted to say, go to more funerals than weddings. Because generally, the funeral is more solitary for you to go to than the wedding. Now, he didn't say not go to weddings, but the idea is that we just need to remember that we're going to tend to want to go to positive and joyful things, but we have to sort of discipline ourselves to also go visit the sick, go to those who are struggling or mourning or are having a hard time, counsel, spend some time with them. This is a good and a salutary thing, and it keeps things in proper perspective for us, okay? And then finally it says, in whatever you do, remember your own last day, and you'll never sin. So, and this is something that we're not too good about today. I think I've told you this, at every funeral that I preach, I always say, you're going to die. You are going to die. What are you doing to get ready to meet God? And we need to think about this a lot. We live in a culture that is able to kind of not look at death as much as other cultures before us. Because, first of all, we tend to send our elderly and sick away to hospitals and nursing homes to die. They don't die in our own house like they used to. That was very common 100 years ago for grandma to die right there in the family bed. You know, there just wasn't a lot of going to the hospital as there is today. Nursing homes and so on. You tended to... Death was a regular occurrence in most households. Every couple of years, if not every year, somebody would die right there in the house. You'd take care of the body, get it ready for burial. We're very insulated from this today. Likewise, we tend, because of our medical things, you know, we're very good at kind of postponing death a lot and kind of beating it back and not having to look at it. But in the end, so we're not as familiar today with what we might call very sudden deaths. Now, they do happen, of course. I think of Wynette right out here in the hallway who died so suddenly. But generally speaking, in the old, you know, up to about 100 years ago, I mean, you could just have been perfectly fine on Monday and be dead by Tuesday afternoon of some crazy virus or just diarrhea or God knows what. I mean, it's amazing how quickly you could die in the old days. You could be healthy one moment and by the end of the week be dead. Now, that's still true today, but less so. So for all these reasons, we need to kind of remember, kind of consciously remind ourselves about death as a reality. Even at funerals, that's why I often say to people, you know, are you paying attention? That's what I have to basically say to the congregation. Are you paying attention? Look at this. There's a casket. There's a person in there that we all knew and loved. I mean, I'm not quite that crazy. But because it's amazing how unreflective we can be about this. We can just even go to a funeral and just see, la-di-da, good to see you again. And by the way, there's the dead person over there. Hi, I kind of did a few prayers and just kind of put it out of my mind. And did Father preach a good sermon or not? Did I like the music? And not even think, my God, somebody I knew is dead. And I'm next. Same train, came from my mother, same train, be back tomorrow, same train. Okay, well, we're done. So, for today. Okay, let's pray. Lord, we finished in chapter 7, and a lot of wisdom for us today. I always feel the same with the Lord at the end of these classes, like my little Dixie cup in front of the fire hydrant, and so many things have been discussed, so many thoughts. Your word is so rich here, and I just ask, Lord, that I can retain from this class today what you want me to retain. I'll probably forget a lot of it. I'll need to be reminded of it, Lord. So I pray though, at least that I'll retain right now what you intend for me to retain. And I know that, Lord, you'll repeat a number of these things as we go along. Mm-hmm. So asking, Lord, that all of us can hear this word, listen to its wisdom, get proper perspective. For we do live in a world gone mad, a world that has neglected many, many of these teachings. So we ask a blessing that we can begin to internalize them and judge the world by these teachings. Through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you all.